Chapter 9. And I don't want the world to see me, 'cause I don't think that they'd understand. When everything's made to be broken, I just want you to know who I am. By the time Jaster returns from yet another full exam of his wounded son, this time overseen by very displeased medical droids, and at least 20 times as amusing as it was the last time for that reason, his bedroom is dim and quiet, and John is asleep on the bed, a book still in his hand. Just for a moment, Jaster stands still and struck in the doorway, not able to say why the scene makes something twist in his chest, but the feeling is there all the same. There's one light still on, close to the door, and all the others have been extinguished. Left on for him, he thinks, and steps in, letting the door close quietly behind him. John doesn't stir, clearly exhausted by the events of the evening, even when Jaster leans over him, carefully freeing the book from his lax fingertips. He just sighs a little, half turning his head into the pillow. "Thank you again," Jaster murmurs, and can't resist the urge to brush John's hair back, just barely skimming the scars that cross his jaw. Claws, Jaster thinks, and fits his fingers to them. Something large, with equally large claws, and the fact that John survived is, well, something of a running theme, it seems. He strikes Jaster as very good at surviving. Jaster changes as quietly as he's able, then carefully eases back the blankets on the far side of the bed and slides in, settling back against the pillows. He doesn't quite intend to reach out, but all the same, John turns toward him in his sleep, curling closer to his warmth, and Jaster can't resist the urge to slide an arm beneath him, pull him in. John comes readily, not waking, just curling into his side, and Jaster strokes his hair back, smiling a little. The sight of John and Django hauling themselves out of the gardens in a lurching stagger was a vicious sort of relief, and not one Jaster had expected. Even that much camaraderie was far outside the bounds of Jaster's expectations for their interactions, and he can't help a wash of warm amusement as he strokes a hand down John's bare back. John seems kind, careful with others and focused on their reactions more than his own. Jaster hasn't met more than a handful of Jedi personally, can't say if most of them treat interactions the same way, but it seems novel, almost startling. Little care for himself, Jaster thinks, and after the way John beat Montross, he likely should have recognized the theme. His own body on the line, a sacrifice in the name of saving others, and it's not a Mandalorian thing, not precisely. They've always been focused on clans and family and partners over anything, but not incompatible, perhaps. Political marriages aren't uncommon, even in a society that prizes family and raising children into strong warriors. Jaster hadn't exactly expected to be subjected to one himself, but that's more an extension of the fact that he never expected to find himself a Mandalore either. He's wanted change, had intended to publish his reforms and drag at least those around him forward into them, but finding that a huge swath of Mandalorians were eager for the same change, for the shift into something honorable and relatively respectable, was well beyond what he'd thought possible. Jaster grew up a farmer's son. He killed a man when he was younger than Django is now, because he hadn't been able to find another solution. Because he'd been angry, and nothing in the world had worked as it was supposed to. Things are better now, even with the Civil War, and Jaster knows that, but sometimes it's hard to see past that moment on Concord Dawn. The smirk the other protector had been wearing, the look on their commander's face when he turned Jaster away. "We're hired guns, Mareel. If you expect honor from any of us, you're too naive to live." Jaster did expect honor. He still does. Honor and a willingness to sacrifice for the good of his people, and the most deeply ironic thing about this whole situation is the fact that he's found a complimentary drive in his people's traditional enemy. The enemy he's marrying. Jaster slides his thumb across a wide, dark scar that looks like a whip mark, slanting across John's back. Closes his eyes, a little rueful, a little tired, and then looks down at the dark head resting on his shoulder. a Jedi, scarred and quiet and wary. And some part of Jaster is still surprised that John hasn't vanished in the middle of the night yet, even with his wounds. Instead, he's taken all of Jaster's maneuvering, all of these plans that he should by all rights oppose, just on tradition, and given himself over to them entirely. Given that Jaster had largely expected to spend the rest of his life having to wave around his marriage certificate to prove he had a spouse, it's astonishing. There's a heavy breath against his shoulder, and a bored twitch. Blue eyes slide open, aware but not alarmed, and Jaster half expects John to pull away, to slide out of his grip, but instead, John shifts closer. He makes a low, throaty sound, burying his face in Jaster's chest, and Jaster chuckles. "Cold, John," he asks softly, and John doesn't answer verbally, but his hum is low and agreeable. With a huff of amusement, Jaster shifts, halfway rolls John and then catches him with an arm across his chest before he can pull away entirely. He resettles on his side, pulls John back against his body and curls around him, and John's breath out is a shuddering thing, relief and something Jaster can't parse. He reaches up, gripping Jaster's arm even as he sinks back against him, and Jaster lightly strokes another scar that cuts across his collarbone. "You're all right," he murmurs, and he can't see John's face like this, but the tremor that runs through him is easy to feel. Bad dreams lingering, Jaster thinks, and rests his forehead against John's hair, his other hand stroking across John's stomach. John settles easily enough, readily enough, letting himself relax into the curve of Jaster's body, and he fits there perfectly. Jaster closes his eyes, his own weariness weighing at him, and breathes out. The stress of the day isn't quite enough to blot out the body in his arms, but it's a political marriage. Even if Jaster hadn't intended to have such a relationship, even if John is startlingly willing to be led down this path, it's still not right to dwell on anything physical, and Jaster won't. "I think Zarin likes you," is the first thing Miles says when John opens the door, and he pushes a pile of packages right into John's chest. "Congratulations, destroy as many clothes as you can to stay in her good graces." John blinks, caught off guard, and takes a step back as he tries to keep the bundles from falling. "Destroying things makes her happy?" he asks, confused, and Miles snorts. "Yes," he says without hesitation, marching right past John and into the room. Zarin likes a challenge and any excuse to break out her blaster-resistant fabric. "Good morning, Mandalore." "Judging by that tone, it's not," Jaster says dryly, lowering his book. He studies Miles's face for a moment, then pushes his breakfast aside with a sigh and asks, "Something went wrong?" Miles grimaces, taking the seat across from him. John takes one look at them and sets the rest of the clothes on the bed, fingers itching for his cloak. There's something grim hanging around Miles, and it's rising in Jaster as well. A dark, heavy, unhappy anticipation, trained by experience. "The governor is giving us until the end of next week to remove ourselves before she deploys the journeyman protectors," Miles says, and Jaster mutters a curse, sinking back in his chair and rubbing his hands over his face. "You're still wanted here, and until the war is settled with a clear winner, she's hedging her bets." "She's a coward," Jaster says sharply, then stops, seems to remember himself, and sighs. "The wedding falls just under her deadline," Miles says, deceptively even. "Otherwise, I'd be having this conversation with her and two blasters. But I hope you're prepared to have your honeymoon somewhere else." "She's certainly not making this easy," Jaster says, and glances up. "Are we sure she isn't working with the Death Watch?" Miles hesitates, and that alone likely says enough, John thinks. He glances from Jaster and Miles to the window, where the sun is just rising over the distant mountains, and tries to get a feel for what's coming. There's a vague sense of urgency, but it's an urgency that's centered on Jaster, and John has to curl his hands together in his sleeves for a moment. Something is coming, but hard to say what, hard to plan for it. "I feel," Miles finally says, "that if she were actively working with the Death Watch, we'd have already been overrun." Jaster smiles, crooked. A fair point, he allows, and glances over. John, do you know of her? Any rumors about her? John shakes his head, and when Jaster pushes out the other chair around the small table, he carefully crosses to sit, steadier than last night, but still sore. If there's been word, I haven't heard it, he says quietly. But I can ask other Jedi who might know something. Please, Miles says plainly. The look on his face makes John think of his reaction to learning that the tunnels beneath the house were a risk, that there was a potential traitor among the ranks of the new Mandalorians. The stubble he's sporting hasn't gotten any better since John last saw him. Concord Dawn has been adamant about staying out of the conflict since Governor Cast took over. We haven't been able to get much of a presence in her government, but I'm not sure if that means the same for Death Watch. Do you need a comm? Jaster asks, reaching out. He catches John's wrist, and John almost startles at the heat of his touch, even though he knows it's coming, even though there's nothing but a brief brush of skin before Jaster's hand closes around John's. Miles and I can continue this in his office if you would like privacy. John swallows, and it takes effort to drag his mind away from the grip of Jaster's broad fingers. I'll go out into the garden, he says, and when Jaster opens his mouth to protest, he adds, just to the steps. Some Jedi are protective of their undercover roles. Understandable, Jaster says, and rises, hand sliding down John's arm to cup his elbow and help him to his feet. The mornings here are cool. Take your cloak. Bemused, John reaches out, and the length of heavy cloth whirls from its hook and right into his hand. Dark Woman would berate him for unnecessary use of the Force, but the way interest kindles in Jaster's eyes, sparks through his being, is more than justification enough for a little bit of indulgence. John has never been shy about his use of the Force either. She would have plenty of other reasons to berate him regardless. All the uses for Jedi magic that the books leave out, Jaster says dryly, but he steps closer, taking the cloak from John's fingers. Deftly, he tosses it around John's shoulders, and John slides his arms through the loose sleeves, pulling it closed at his throat. Jaster helps, and the brush of his fingers sliding through John's makes it hard to breathe steadily. Thank you, he says quietly, and Jaster smiles faintly. Do you need help out there? He asks, hand going to John's elbow again. The Jedi is fine, Miles says dryly. And when John glances up to meet his gaze, Miles rolls his eyes, though it's fond. He might be Mandalore, but you can tell him to go stick his head in a bucket if he gets overbearing. Jaster makes a noise of offense, and it gets louder when he sees John duck his head to hide his own amusement. I am surrounded by traitors, he says derisively, though he doesn't drop his hand from John's arm. And what is your opinion on this, John? John might be bad with people, but he can recognize a quagmire to be avoided when it's actively unfolding at his feet. I don't need help right now, he offers, as diplomatically as he's able, and Miles snorts. Jaster huffs, but it's amused rather than offended, and he lets go and steps back. Deftly avoided, he says dryly. Miles, if I calm the governor. Miles' sigh is loud and pointed. Mandalore, I would follow you and your line into any amount of danger, would risk my life for you, will serve you until the end of my days. But if you get yourself arrested for murder less than 8 days before your wedding, you won't have to worry about the Death Watch because I will kill you. John slips out the door, trying not to smile too obviously at the prickly sort of fondness that's underlying the conversation. There is a heavy layer of dew over the stone of the steps, and it's a little colder than is entirely comfortable, but John wraps himself more thoroughly in his cloak and sinks down, pulling the sleeve back enough to steady his calm. He could calm the Order itself, put the request about Concord Dawn's governor to the intelligence arm of the Jedi, but that requires talking to the Order, and John tends not to. Even when he meets Madame Nu to pass on things he's found, he tries to arrange for it somewhere other than Coruscant. Partially because Coruscant itself is overwhelming, but it's also uncomfortable. Dark Woman never encouraged contact with the Council, or the Order as a whole, and some part of that ingrained avoidance still lingers. But there are some Jedi who work in the Outer Rim, even if most have to concentrate their time and effort on more populated areas. Dark Woman would work with some of them, if rarely, and John does technically know the channels and signals to use to contact them for assistance, even if he's never used them before. John was trained to be self-sufficient, and asking for help means he wasn't good enough, means he failed. This is different, though. This is about Jaster and information John doesn't have access to, and he breathes in, breathes out, and sends a short query out along one of the more common channels, a simple request for information to anyone in range. There's no immediate answer, but then John doesn't expect one. Not many Jedi come to the Outer Rim, and any who are nearby are likely deep in their missions. Settling himself more comfortably, John closes his eyes and breathes out, a fraction of his attention on Jaster and Miles in the room, but the rest assessing, cataloging his own body. He doesn't feel quite as worn thin as before, and being able to summon his cloak across the room without strain is a good sign. Healing takes more energy than most things, but soon, John thinks. Before the wedding, certainly, which is likely for the best. Something is going to happen, and he and Miles both feel it. Knowing Jaster is probably a shatter point just drives the urgency higher, makes John more certain that things are converging. Between Jaster and Arla and Jango all heralding some sort of change, and the fact that Jaster ended up on the planet where Montross died, just in time to save John, it means something. There are no coincidences. The Force moves them all, in ways that reveal the pattern of the threads, and John won't look away until he can tease out the meaning. The uncertainty of last night was settled by his walk through the full weight of the Force, and John can accept that even if he has his own desires, even if they're strong, they're secondary. Jaster is more important. The quiet chime of his comm brings him out of his meditation, and John takes several slow moments to open his eyes, to recenter himself in a world that's more immediate, and then he brings his comm up. The code isn't one he recognizes, but there's a request pending for a holotransmission, and John frowns faintly, tugs his hood up over his head, and accepts it. With a shimmer of blue light, the small image of a human man rises, clad in traditional robes, with long dark hair and an impressive mustache. He looks John over with narrowed eyes, then says, "Your code isn't one I recognize, my friend." There's nothing friendly about the words, and John hesitates for an instant, then dips his head in a half bow and says, "Master Dyeth, I was Dark Woman's student." Nico Dyeth doesn't answer for a long moment, studying John closely. "Your hood," he says at length. "Remove it." John hides a grimace, but reaches up, pushing the dark cloth back down. He remembers Nico from a pair of missions he helped Dark Woman with, when John was barely a Padawan, and the fierce, loud arguments Dark Woman and Nico ended up in that ended any further missions together. But he was kind to John, at least, and John hopes that he doesn't refuse to help just because John is connected to Dark Woman. "I'm sorry to interrupt your mission, Master Dyeth," he says, and makes himself raise his head, even knowing the reactions even other Jedi have to his scars. Dark Woman knows how to heal well enough not to leave scars, but John was always a poor student. "As my message said, I'm looking for information on Mandalorian space, if you have it." "I wouldn't have answered if I didn't," Nico says impatiently, but his gaze is still on John's face, narrow and thoughtful. After several long seconds, he huffs and folds his hands into his sleeves. "You are Anya's student, if taller than you were last time we met. Tell me, did she ever give you a name?" John weighs two different answers, then says carefully, "I'm called John Antilles." Nico snorts, not fooled. "A name you gave yourself, I assume," he says, sour, though John doesn't think it's directed at him. He inclines his head, and Nico scowls, but waves a hand at him. "Thank you, Knight Antilles. You may put up your hood if you like. I just wish to be sure." A little relieved, John pulls it up over his head again. Hiding, but allowable. Nico said he was fine with it. "Master Antilles," he corrects quietly. One of Nico's brows rises, and he smiles faintly. "My mistake then, Master Antilles. How long ago did you make Master?" 5 years, John says, and Nico goes still, eyes narrowing sharply. It makes John pause, not sure if he should continue, but after a moment, Nico simply mutters something in Hatties and waves him on. John can't quite parse the reaction, and he hesitates, then asks, "Were you not sure I was a Jedi?" Nico's sigh is annoyed, and he rubs a hand over his face. "My partner," he says derisively, managed to get himself captured, and I'm in the process of planning a rescue. There have been several ransom attempts that I am entirely uninterested in indulging, as it was Dooku's own idiocy that got him kidnapped by a Hutt. John weighs that for a moment, then asks, "Do you need help?" He needs to stay with Jaster and Jango and Arla, but if it's close and he's careful and he moves quickly, Nico's expression softens and he smiles. "Thank you, John, but I will manage," he says. "If two masters cannot outwit one Hutt, I do believe we should both leave the Order in shame." Another sweep of his gaze over John, and then he says more quietly, "You're injured." "I'm safe," John says, "but I'm following the Mandalorian Death Watch and trying to uncover some of their ties. Do you know anything about the governor of Concord Dawn?" Nico puts up a hand, stroking his mustache. "Aga Cast, wasn't it? I know she's had dealings with Gardula the Hutt, but I'm less certain about the Death Watch. There's never been any mention of her having sympathies for them. If anything, she's seen her people suffer more than most under their attacks. I will ask several of my less savory contacts, but I believe you should be safe enough in assuming she truly means her words about staying neutral in the Civil War." The words settle the edge of tension that's been creeping up John's spine, and he inclines his head. "Thank you, Master Dyeth," he says quietly. "I appreciate you sparing the time, particularly in the middle of a rescue." Nico snorts. "Hardly a rescue. I simply want to laugh in Dooku's face for his sheer incompetence." He pauses, mouth curling in a half frown, and then asks, "Do you need help, John? Dooku will be willing to lend his assistance as well, if required. The Jedi do not often involve themselves in matters within Mandalorian space, and hunting the Death Watch seems more dangerous than any one Jedi should be expected to handle." John has no idea how to answer that, not even the faintest impression of what he can say, or should. Telling Nico that he's doing it for his husband-to-be, the Mandalore, seems like a bad idea. Just telling Nico that he's allied with the true Mandalorians will likely raise far too many questions. "I'm fine," he settles on. Nico doesn't look convinced. "Thank you, Master Dyeth." Nico hums, displeased, but doesn't press. "Keep my comm code," he orders. "Contact me for anything you require. It is good to know other Jedi who work in the Outer Rim." John will, since it's a direct request. He nods, moving to end the transmission, but before he can, Nico reaches out. "John," he says quietly, but that tone is grave enough to make John look at him with some surprise. "Are you still in contact with Anya?" John hesitates. "Not often," he says quietly. I think the Council gave her a new Padawan, a Paladuvan girl. She's been busy." Nico's frown deepens, and he nods curtly. "Thank you, John," he says, and the transmission winks out with a faint hum. "Anya?" Jaster asks from behind John, and deliberately steps across the stone. A moment later, Jaster sinks down next to John on the top step, leaning forward. John closes his eyes at the way Jaster's fingers skim his cheek, calloused fingers drawing a line of heat across his skin as Jaster gently tugs his hood back down. "My master," John manages, though he doesn't want to think about Dark Woman right now. Just about Jaster and the heat of him so close, his thigh practically pressed to John's. That was her name before she gave it up. Some Jedi still use it, but most people call her Dark Woman. Jaster raises a brow, but doesn't comment. "Is she close? You could ask her to be a witness to the wedding." John can't even begin to put into words what a terrible idea that would be. He shakes his head, too quick, and says, I don't think she would approve of any of this." Something crosses Jaster's face, twisted, conflicted. He looks at John for a long moment, then breathes out and leans in, offering him his arm. "Blame me," he suggests, and his smile is faintly wry. "Seeing as all of this was my grand plan, and I am certainly not about to let one Jedi's disapproval stop me from securing a future for my people. A shatterpoint, John thinks. He hasn't outright checked, hasn't had the strength, but he's sure of it. Jaster is a shatterpoint, breaking the old ways, and John needs to see to it that he keeps moving, keeps fracturing the status quo. Swallowing, John curls a hand around Jaster's arm, letting Jaster pull him to his feet. I think, he says quietly, that you've made the right choice, for what it's worth. Jaster smiles, just a little, and wraps his arm around John's waist. It's worth quite a lot, he says, and leads John back into the bedroom, his grip never wavering. End of chapter 9.